You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means one thing. It is time for our reporter roundtable. This is where we get you up to date on all kinds of news that made headlines this past week around our region. There's been quite a bit of that. Our guest today, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, Jimmy Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press. Happy Friday, everyone.
Hey.
So we are going to go back a little bit and talk once again about this letter from 28 legislators to Boise State's newly minted president, Marlene Trump, regarding diversity and inclusivity, because we have been getting a reaction from lawmakers. And in fact, there was a GOP town hall in Twin Falls, and House Majority Leader Mike Moyle had something to say about it. So we want to play a clip of this really quick.
You know, I don't know how many of you in here think it'd be all right to have graduations at, say, BSU for only white people. Does that sound like a good idea? Well, the letter talks about it only for black people. What's the difference? My concern is when you go down that road where we start picking and choosing different groups, we've got a problem. In my humble opinion, diversification brings us all together. You know, today I went by and was checking one of my herds of cattle. I got red cattle out there, I've got black cattle out there, I've got red and white cattle out there, and I've got black and white cattle out there, and it doesn't matter, they're all cattle. When we start taking the step that I'm concerned that the university is, and again, I encourage you to read that letter. When you read that letter, some of you may change your mind about why some of us signed that other letter. You will see that my concern is we're starting to break us up in groups. The red cattle and the black cattle and the other. And that's not what diversification is. It's about us all being equal and all being on the same boat and all working together for a common cause, not making one group more special for some other reason. That's my concern. I don't know where this is going to end. I don't know how it's going to all work out. But I think we can all agree that diversification is important. But I also think we can all agree that we're all the same, that we should all be treated equally, that nobody is more special than somebody else. And that's my concern.
So, Jimmy, let's talk about that. This was something that's, in fact, because his comments, I think, were, you know, in a smaller region, it hasn't gotten as much media attention, frankly, when he basically talks about his cattle, referring that, I mean, basically making an argument that different color of cattle are the exact same thing as different races of people.
Yeah, I know that the Times News out of Twin Falls reported a little bit on it. We reported on it this morning as well. We had a reporter, Rachel Cohen, there mm-hmm. who got that audio along with a whole host of other things that they talked about during that town hall. But the letter he's referring to is the July 9th letter from State Representative Barbara Ehart, who got together this group of 27 other lawmakers, including herself, making it 28, talking about how, you know, these things like diversity programs and, you know, specific graduation ceremonies are, quote, unnecessary costs. They segregate students, all of these things. And that was in response to a letter that former interim president Marty Schimpf had written to the Boise State community talking about, yep, we're proud to offer these programs. This is great. And they do not like the way that Boise State is going in that direction. So things escalated this week when state lawmakers were mailed postcards with the new Boise State president, Marlene Trump, characterized as a clown with the State Board of Education in the background, face paint on them, et cetera. The postcard called these programs a clown world and really just kind of took aim at that. I had seen this cartoon a few days before on Twitter when, Bjorn Handeen, who's the District 1 chair for the state GOP, posted it there saying he got it emailed to him. And then Governor Brad Little briefly mentioned this cartoon this week in a newsletter. He called it distasteful and that it belittles volunteers and workers who dedicate their time to advancing opportunities for Idaho mm-hmm. students. The thing that I noticed, though, he called it an out-of-state postcard, but the thing is, there's no sorting facility in northern Idaho. Everything is routed through Spokane.
And it had a Spokane postmark on it.
Right, yeah. Most importantly, he had no reaction to the original letter from Representative Ehart, which is what people have been clamoring to get. Idaho Ed News, in fact, asked him earlier this week, but a spokesperson said that he was out of state traveling on business mm-hmm. and couldn't comment.
And his comment even about this clown caricature. He said it's distasteful, but yet didn't he also say, Jimmy, that, I mean, it's freedom of speech?
Yeah, I think he did call it distasteful, and he said, you know, I do not condone this, but yes, it is freedom of speech, which is a core tenet of our democracy. Mm-hmm.
And we, I do want to note that, last Monday, we spoke right here on Idaho Matters with Representative E. Hart and Representative Matt Erbelding, specifically about that letter. So I think if you have not heard that interview, I think it's worth listening to get her perspective as to why she decided to really take up this fight.
Mm-hmm.
Another big, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think it's worth mentioning that Dr. Marlene Trump, who is kind of at the center of this controversy and has become a bit of a sensation on Twitter in the last few weeks with Garth Brooks pictures and other things, tweeted a picture of a cartoon, a separate cartoon that she received that said, "Welcome to Boise State," and it appears to be a picture of her with Buster Bronco. And she said, "One of our academic advising staff had this made for me at Comic-Con. It's Buster and me. I like this far better than other cartoons I've seen this week, smiley face. Thanks, Megan." So she addressed it in her own way.
You know, I thought that was really interesting because I have to say, I have been very impressed with her social media skills and how she's using that to address things without maybe getting too political right now with her being new in this position.
I think it's always fair to kind of be mindful of Twitter and what it is. It's something that only reaches about 20% of the population of Boise. It's a lot of reporters and political types and people who like sports, and the president of Boise State University kind of hits all three of those areas. And so I think it's careful. It's important to sort of step back and say, how impactful is Twitter on the greater discourse? It's not, other than it influences the influencers.
Mm-hmm. The other big story right now, Rebecca, it is the sheep fire over in eastern Idaho. You have been covering this diligently this week. So Talk to us about this, because right now the largest fire in the lower 48, correct?
Correct. So this was a big deal because it was burning on the sort of sprawling nuclear research site that is the Idaho National Laboratory, sort of near Idaho Falls, covers about 890 square miles. I mean, this is a big,
it's big
property, and it is mostly open rangeland, which, and it, you know, we all know how the wind blows in
It never Idaho. Stops blowing right. in eastern Idaho.
So when you have a rangeland fire, the potential to spread is can happen really quickly, and it can cover a lot of ground. That's what sort of happened at INL. So actually, at one point, the fire was pressing near the buildings out there. Now, of course, the buildings at INL have things like nuclear reactors.
This is very Stranger Things, as
right?
That's where Stranger Things is.
This is a preview of season 4.
Well, it is.
So, you know, there's a lot of valuable equipment. There's a lot of radioactive material out there. And this is something that the Department of Energy takes very seriously, you know, protecting that equipment from fires and other natural disasters. And here's the thing, though. Fires aren't uncommon out there. I mean, it's open rangeland. Mm-hmm. Usually they're human caused. Somebody drives their car off the road and the hot engine, you know, sparks the sagebrush and then you get a fire. Those ones are usually caught pretty quickly because somebody sees them and they report them right away. But the sheep fire was caused by a lightning strike on Monday evening. And so by Tuesday, it had spread pretty large. I think it's currently about 177 square miles of ground. But the good news is it is almost completely contained. This morning, the National Interagency Fire Center said it was about 95% contained. The fire behavior is minimal right now, and it's mostly smoldering. So crews should have that hopefully completely controlled.
And I think the backdrop for these fires is that we're looking at July to be the hottest month on record ever for the planet. And so when you see these fires, and yeah, they often have characteristics that make them interesting, smoke in the air, threats to INL, but the bigger story here always is our climate is warming,
right?
And we're getting more of these fires that are causing more impacts like this. And I think that's a big piece of what's happening in Idaho and elsewhere.
And I should mention that Boise State Public Radio reporter Rachel Cohen, who Jimmy mentioned, has also been following the sheep fire. And so you can go to our website for more information as Rachel continues to keep us updated. But I also wanted to mention, Rebecca, that at one point they had to evacuate non-essential employees from the INL. And I covered the INL years ago when I was a reporter in Idaho Falls. And I can't remember a time where there was a fire that they actually felt that they needed to evacuate employees.
Right. And so that was in part because of smoke. but also in part because it was getting closer than they have, I think, previously experienced to these buildings. I couldn't get an actual distance from the folks at INL because the buildings were all sort of very, you know, I mean, fires don't move in a giant square, right? They're sort of amorphous. And so it's kind of hard to measure that stuff while the fires are actually burning actively. But yeah, they got all of the non-essential personnel out for 2 days. And they just resumed operations, normal operations out there on Thursday. But they were doing air quality monitoring the entire time, and they did not detect any radioactivity beyond normal background levels. So that's a big deal because watchdog groups really pay attention. Mm-hmm. Nuclear watchdog groups really pay attention to what can cause radioactive releases. And obviously those are no good for anybody. And so...
So that's the upside of it.
The upside of it. There was none of that. And, you know, these sorts of fires do have... They happen at Hanford. They happen at nuclear sites in California, Colorado.
Well, because this is the land where they put these reactors.
Right. They put them in open rural areas.
Right.
Where sometimes, as we all know in Idaho, fire happens.
Fire happens, yeah. So, Don, I want to talk about some new buffered bike lanes in downtown Boise. Because apparently... There's a lot of confusion here. And Jimmy, you have personal experience with this. But Don, talk to us about this because you reported on this on Boise Dev.
I'll set it up and Jimmy can explain the personal experience. Natalie Hurst over at KBOI, actually, to her credit, first noticed this. On one street, the lane marker lines kind of going to go...
And we're talking what? Main Street and Fairview.
Fairview, yeah. And this is in the western part of downtown, so I think by the Red Lion and over by Channel 2's studios. And then on the other side, and I've got a picture up on BoiseDev.com that you can see. So imagine that you're centered in a lane with your vehicle, and you're looking across the intersection. And usually you would think, okay, well, the lanes on the other side of the intersection, I'm going to stay between them. The photo shows the lanes right dead set center in the middle of your field of vision. So there's some challenges here, and I reached out to the Ada County Highway District, and spokesperson Nicole Dubois over there gave me one of the great quotes from a spokesperson in a long time. So thank you, Nicole, for that. She said, The striping plan looked good on paper, but doesn't drive well. So what they're trying to do...
Are we going to change the striping plan?
Yeah, so it sounds like the plan looked good, but when they executed it, it didn't work. They're working to add some buffer bike lanes there and decrease the number of vehicle travel lanes. If you've driven Fairview and Main in that area, it's like five lanes and wide open, and it doesn't really make sense anymore. It's kind of a relic of an era before the connector. The city has pushed to make some changes here with the bike lanes and some parking and other things, and I think Jimmy has actually seen this.
So Jimmy, I mean, this is part of your commute.
It is, yeah. So, I mean, going home, it just kind of sprung up out of nowhere. I had no idea it was happening. One day I'd drive to work, and then later that day I drive home, and suddenly... whole new striping pattern, and it was kind of almost like an obstacle course in places because the lines are so jerky and really like at
That's
an
helpful.
Angle. Yeah. So it was just interesting because we were trying to play a game of, is this a bus lane? What exactly is this new solid white line going on the right-hand side of the road?
So the falling action here is that ACHD has figured out this isn't going to work. They're not going to do any more striping. So they put tabs up, those little, you know, sticky tabs that kind of indicate the lanes.
It's
a temporary measure while they go back and reassess. They don't want to do anything more and then have to remove it. So they're going to make some more changes.
Those are also, off-center from the current lanes.
Right. Yeah. Oh, great.
So listeners understand that this is not just one zag. This is like...
a bunch.
You zag one way, and then you zig the other, and then it's like...
It's almost like a slalom, yeah.
Yeah.
For cars. Oh, that's fun.
And
great.
Looked, and if you're on a... Even if you're cycling, like, I'm like, which one's the bike lane? What's the buffer? Where's parking? I could not.
Okay, so this is just a matter of time until something goes wrong.
And to be fair, Joe Drasuski, who's a former Statesman photographer on the Boise Dev Board of Advisors, drove it on his bike. He's a big cycling fan. He'll be glad to know he was mentioned here, and he said it was great. So I think it will improve that experience for cyclists. Right now, it's just a little chaotic.
So just figuring out the right fit, because I never thought about that area. I mean, I realized it always had so many lanes, but it's right. It's pre-connector. You don't need all those lanes. There's never traffic there.
No, for sure. And that area is a part of town that is going to redevelop in coming years, likely home to a new ballpark and some other things. We talked a few weeks ago about the Torch being for sale. And there's lots of redevelopment possibilities in that part of town.
Where is the Torch in all of this? Still for sale?
I think this is the third time I brought up the Torch on Idaho Matters, and I'm quite proud of that, in fact.
We're going to continue.
We'll get you a plaque.
I know, right? We're going to continue the reporter roundtable right after this. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We are continuing our reporter roundtable. Our panel today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and our own Jimmy Dawson. So, Jimmy, I want to get back to you. There is a case, this was just in the Idaho Press this morning, where the city of Boise will be spending what? Into the six figures, I believe. And this is to defend a former police lieutenant who was accused of selling weapons out of his office at City Hall.
Yeah, City Hall West. Yeah, this is an extraordinary story out of the Idaho Press. Apparently, Margaret Carmel found that Boise is paying $100,000 to defend this retired lieutenant. Like you said, he was allegedly selling guns on duty out of his office at City Hall West. This Boise Police Department corporal named Norman Carter claims he was retaliated against after he kind of reported this activity. Apparently, he says that this former Lieutenant Greg Oster had been doing this. He also specifically noted in the lawsuit that Margaret reported on that he even had a sticker for his business that he was putting on Boise Police Department cars.
No, he was not.
Yeah, well, according to the lawsuit, it was. And so the corporal says that retaliation caused him to resign as this use of force instructor. So he missed out on overtime, you know, all this stuff. And the Idaho Press says it just outlines these allegations, which include that Lieutenant Oster was selling guns openly through this private business from 2012 to 2018. There was an investigation, but Boise police say that it was a personnel matter. They're not releasing it. And this trial is set for October 2nd right now.
And shout out to Margaret. This was on the city of Boise's consent agenda, which is a rundown of items that the council deems to be routine. So they approved the increase with a whole bunch of other things. There's typically, you know, travel requests and spending and all that. So this was kind of just sitting there, and there are several reporters who cover City Hall, including me, who didn't notice it, but Margaret did. And so the city voted on it unanimously to throw more money into the pot to defend this.
So trial, though.
Yeah, trial set for October 2nd. So far, I guess the city has spent about $60,000 on lawyers for defending this. And I'm really eager to see what comes out of this, especially if that personnel investigation is brought up at trial.
Do we know what the charges are, Jimmy, that he's being...
Well, it's a civil suit.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Civil.
Right. There's no criminal case so far in this. I don't know if there even can be. We're in the newsroom. We're trying to figure out, is it even like legal to sell these guns out of your office? I mean, or is it just a departmental thing? Who knows?
Well, and what ethical issues could potentially come up with something like that?
Right.
Right. When you're especially doing this for a, you know, while you're on the job. Rebecca, let's talk about the Attorney General's office. Attorney General Wasden has filed a lawsuit against drug manufacturers. So get us up to date on what this is, because this, as we all know, in regards to the opioid epidemic.
Right. So this is actually the second lawsuit he has filed against drug manufacturers, and this one also is against drug distributors. He is bringing racketeering charges, he's suing for racketeering, rather. So Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Johnson & Johnson, Teva Pharmaceuticals, Endo Pharmaceuticals, other distributors, saying that they sort of worked together to promote a false narrative about the safety of opioids. And that because of that directly contributed to the opioid epidemic, and that basically people were dying in furtherance of these companies' profits. So the companies have not yet replied to this lawsuit. So we don't know what they say. I did not get I reached out to them for comment. I did not get responses. But this has been something that's been in the news a lot because the opioid epidemic, as we know, has led to a lot of deaths. As a matter of fact, there's been more than 351,000 reported opioid deaths in the U.S. in the last 20 years. Wasden said Idaho's opioid-related death rate nearly tripled between 1999 and 2017. And also, most experts think that count is underestimated because oftentimes, you know, death certificates say drug overdose or whatnot, and they don't necessarily say what kind of drug. But Wasden says the state currently has more than 100,000 residents. And so for Idaho, which is a fairly sparsely populated state comparatively. 100,000 residents is a lot, who are considered chronic opioid users, which means they're taking the drugs for more than 3 months consecutively without at least a week break in there. And so basically, out of all of the Idahoans who are prescribed opioids, about a third of them are chronic users, according to the lawsuit.
I couldn't believe, just as a personal anecdote, I broke my finger last year, and I went and got an initial appointment and was prescribed 50 pills of opioids. And then I went to the hospital and was prescribed another 50 pills of opioids. And I just couldn't believe, like, they were just showering down upon me. So I'd see how easy it is for somebody to get addicted when they're prescribed so readily.
Mm-hmm.
It really stunned me and brought this to light for me in a way that I had never experienced.
Well, and in his lawsuit, Wasden says that there was a real concerted effort to make opioids the standard among the medical community. He says that these companies did things like they hired doctors to go do speaking engagements at big conferences where they would speak, you know, they would just go on glowingly about how effective opioids were.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even, they even, in the lawsuit, Wasden claims these companies even pushed this concept that if somebody is showing the signs of opioid dependency, that was actually a sign that their pain was undertreated and they needed to be prescribed more. So those are among the allegations. So, you know, it's sort of like the influencers, if you think about influencers today, right, and how they can shape thought. Mm-hmm.
We have spoken to doctors here on the program who have talked about even when they were in medical school and what they were taught about opioid use in medical school and the standard of care, which was, Dawn, very similar to your experience. That is shifting now that we are in this epidemic. But similar experience, when I had my last child, I had a C-section. I was not allowed to check out of the hospital until I filled a prescription, which, by the way, I had not been on opioids since the day he was born. I mean, they prescribe, you get cut open, they give you, you know, something. But I literally was not using that for pain management within 24 hours after his birth. And 4 days later, had to fill a prescription before I could be released from the hospital. So there's got to be some type of change. And I would say you are seeing that with doctors, but it's a slow change.
My general practitioner, who I saw this spring on something unrelated, and I was telling him about the finger thing, he said, did they prescribe you, and I won't say the name of the drug, but and I said, yeah. And he said, do you still have the pills at home? And I was like, yeah, they're in the drawer. He's like, you really should take those to the fire station. And I think it's important. You don't throw them out. You take them to the fire station.
Mm-hmm.
Like, get rid of them. It's not good to have in the house. You know, if something else goes wrong, you're like, oh, I'll just take a couple pills. He said, you can see addiction in 2 and 3 days.
That's
so
what
fast.
Shocked me. Yes, they say within 2 to 3
so
days.
So I do think the medical community is starting to be attuned that this is an issue and that they need to stop. But it was only 4 months after doctors in the same health system had prescribed me 100 mm-hmm. pills in 3 days.
Right.
Jimmy, you have been covering this story, and there is new information about this. Former Idaho State GOP Chair Jonathan Parker.
Yeah. So new developments in that saga. Earlier this week, a judge revoked bail for Jonathan Parker on the stalking charge. He had been charged in connection with allegedly stalking his estranged wife because he apparently violated his no contact order with his estranged wife. That's why they revoked the $80,000 bail. Circumstances around that, he apparently, at least according to the hearing this week, prosecutors say he sent a text message to his estranged wife telling her about some kind of medical conditions that he had, and then also asking for a picture of their daughter. And so now he has at least a couple warrants out for his arrest, one including a felony witness intimidation one, which is $100,000 bond. He was arrested in May for the stalking charge, and then ever since then, we've kind of had a few other misdemeanor charges pop up that were kind of backdated before the stalking charge came up. Kind of a complicated timeline here, but on Monday, he does have a pretrial conference check-in. I just checked before we got in here. He has not been arrested yet. I've been constantly updating that mm-hmm. to see if he has, but so far, no appearance in the jail, Ada County Jail.
That could change on Monday. We'll see. Dawn, before we leave, some changes coming to downtown McCall.
Yeah, so I was up in McCall this weekend, and I always like to go gather a bunch of stories while I'm there. And one of them is some pretty significant changes in downtown McCall that will happen over several years. They're going to really kind of redo the guts of downtown. So if you think about when you pull into town and you get to that turn around the lake, the names of the streets people don't remember, so I won't name them, but they're kind of that cross-section that goes around where McCall Drug used to be.
Right.
And Krusty's Pizza. Those roads are in really bad shape. There's actually a great picture that they posted that's up on BoiseDev.com that shows a crosswalk going to a curb, going to another curb with a phone pole and a fire hydrant in the way.
It's like Main Street in Fairview.
Yeah. Except for this has been there for decades, right, and is now going to get fixed. So they're going to add some bike lanes, some plaza areas, street furniture, and all sorts of stuff. This is being funded by a local option tax, and this is an issue I know you've addressed on Idaho Matters a number of times. Cities like Boise and Meridian don't have this option, but Idaho law does have a carve-out for resort cities of less than 10,000 people. So in 2015, the citizens of McCall said, sure, we'll pay an extra cent in non-grocery sales tax to fund this. And so several million dollars are going into infrastructure in McCall. The goal here is to really spruce up that area, add some sidewalk cafes. They even cite what's been done in downtown Boise as a way to be an economic catalyst for that area. And I think it'll be really interesting to see. Projects will wrap up this summer and then each summer for the next several years as they step through this.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I do appreciate you guys taking time out of your day. It's been our reporter roundtable and our panelists today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Jimmy Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks again, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, the dark skies of Idaho. You're listening to Idaho Matters.